Hello, this is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, April 8th. Let's start with the front page. We have a photo of Maroa Forsyth fifth graders, Quinn Hickman, Isabel Garwood, and Hope Helton, petting a goat from Twisted H Farm during the Agucation program at Richland Community College in Decatur on Monday. From Donette Beckett in Decatur. Agriculture, education, link up in local Agucation program. From Richland Community College, farms, learning, come together. A cow, some sheep, goats, bunnies, chicks, and a horse were ready for an audience at Agucation, a hands-on educational agriculture program for local fifth graders held at Richland Community College. The horse was a little surprising, said Maroa Forsyth fifth grader Alba Limani, who attended Monday. It was shedding a lot. And I didn't know bunnies were that small, added Myla McCool. Their classmate Paige Clark found her preferred animal. There's a Highland cow, and that's my favorite, she said. They're so cute. Agucation gives area fifth graders a first-hand approach to agriculture and how it touches their lives. Students from Maroa Forsyth, Warrensburg Latham, and Sangamon Valley are taking part in this year's event. It's essentially a two-hour tour of agriculture, said Jennifer Fink, Director of Information and Ag Literacy Coordinator with the Macon County Farm Bureau. According to Fink, fifth graders are beginning to understand the farm-to-fork concept. For many of them, they are seeing the machinery for the first time, she said. They're seeing farm animals up close. They're able to interact with them. The students also learn, no matter how cute the animals are, they aren't pets. All of the end products that we get from them and the byproducts that we get from them as well. It's things they use all day, at school and at home, Fink said. Maroa Forsyth fifth grade teacher Ashley Stevenson has invited the Macon County Farm Bureau for Ag in the Classroom and other agriculture-related programs at her school. This is really cool to see it all come together, she said, about the end of the school year program. And there's just pure delight out there with the animals. They love that. Agriculture is present in several careers. By the time the students are in middle school, they have been discussing their future, the program director said. That's the time they can check out an ag class or maybe join a 4-H chapter, Fink said. There's a lot of light bulbs that go off during this. If the discussions don't catch their attention, the large farm equipment parked in the RCC parking lot might. Tyler Marsh, salesman for the John Deere dealership AHW based in Clinton, explained what the combines and tractors do in the farming process. I just talk about machinery, he said. They ask me what they cost, what they do, are they dangerous? They ask why the tires are so big. Marsh's father led the program more than 25 years ago. He had the role to make sure all the rotations ran smoothly and planned and coordinated everything, he said. Using various hands-on activities, Haley Jones, 4-H Youth Development Educator for Macon County, focused on the roles and careers it takes to get from the farm to the table. Pizza and its ingredients were used as an example, because everyone likes pizza, she said. Where do those ingredients come from? Pizza doesn't just come from the store. In fact, it takes many different steps to get there. Anae Hunt grew up in Decatur and admits she knew nothing about agriculture. We had no personal connection to that, she said. As a presenter and 4-H Extension Program Coordinator, Hunt has learned about the connections between agriculture and many other careers. The kids don't know that their food is a group project, she said. They don't get that you can do ag and be in art or marketing. Alex Ametis, Maroa Forsyth High School sophomore and FFA member, brought the animals. I love to educate kids about these animals, he said. It's so important, especially with how big Illinois is on ag, animals, and farming. Ametis said he chose the animals based on their appearance. They're super cute and they behave well, Ametis said. I don't want an animal that doesn't want to be here. I don't want to stress them out, and they love the attention. From Tony Reed in Decatur, Decatur Infrastructure. Decatur okays $3 million in road repairs. Plan targets 10 miles of city's most bumpy street surfaces. A bunch of those rough roads around the city that threaten to shake the fillings out of your teeth are destined to get a lot smoother, thanks to a more than $3 million program of upgrades. The Decatur City Council approved the 2026 Local Street Improvement Project, a $3,096,023 package of resurfacing and repairs aimed at taking a big bite out of the problem of deteriorated roads. The city has more than 930 miles of streets, and the improvement project will cover roughly 10 miles of the worst bumpy surfaces at some 22 locations. Among those scheduled for a facelift are South Acorn Drive, South Albany Street, Benton Drive, Bonhomme Court, Columbus Drive, East Grand Avenue, East Hickory Point Road, Highland Road, Lilac Drive, South Linden Avenue, East Marcella Drive, Mesa Drive, Monroe Street, Montgomery Court, Northbrook Drive, East Orchard Street, Perry Drive, Ridgedale Drive, Ridge Lane Drive, Tempe Drive, and East Wood Street. Downtown Decatur and roads around Millikan University are due to receive a more cosmetic version of the road love, with refreshed crosswalks and stop lines for those locations also included as part of the road improvement package. The contract for the work was awarded to Dunn Company, whose winning bid came in at 12% less than an engineer's projection of the total cost. All work should be wrapped up by November 30th. In a memo to the council, City Manager Melissa Hahn said the price of smoother travel is eternal vigilance. The city typically inspects half of the city streets each year and uses the results of those inspections to develop a 5-year plan of proposed pavement projects, she added. Staff uses a cost-benefit approach to prepare the 5-year plan, otherwise known as cost-benefit analysis. This is a managerial system that decides whether outcomes are worthwhile by comparing costs with expected benefits. That said, however, council members were still curious how the crucial decision of which road gets the love and which doesn't is made. So if you have two streets with the same level of degradation and you have to choose one, how do you choose it? Asked the council. Our last story from the front page is from Nicole Hytrek, Capital News, Illinois, from Springfield. Lawmakers push new abortion access measure. Governor J.B. Pritzker and Democrats have added a new abortion access measure to their agenda that would allow people with limited or no insurance to get financial assistance for abortion care in Illinois. House Bill 5408 would take advantage of an underused provision of the Affordable Care Act that requires insurance plans that offer coverage for abortions in instances that go beyond rape, incest, and life of the mother to collect at least $1 a month from enrollees to cover the cost of abortion claims. Federal law requires the insurers to segregate that money and use it only for abortion care. Illinois' bill would allow the state to exert greater authority over the funds. The bill is meant to give insurers clarity about how to use the money they collect, according to Representative Anna Mueller, Democrat Elgin, who sponsored the bill. She also said another reason for the bill is because the state doesn't have a clear picture of the amount of funds being collected. Similar bills have passed in California and Maryland and are under consideration in Massachusetts and Washington State to require the insurance industry to release these funds and put them into these kind of grant programs so that people can access these services if they don't have insurance or they're underinsured, Mueller said in an interview with Capital News Illinois. So I think maybe the insurance industry didn't have the clarity on how to use it. In California, actual amounts collected haven't been reported publicly, but analysts have estimated it could be more than $100 million. When Maryland's law was expanded in 2025, insurers had collected $25 million. Under its law, the Maryland Health Department allocates up to $2.5 million annually. In Illinois, Mueller said, there's not a lot of clarity when it comes to fund balances. The Illinois Department of Insurance said it was unable to speculate about pending legislation and didn't provide an estimate for how much money has been collected in these accounts. HB 5408 would require insurance companies to report to the Department of Insurance how much money is in these separate accounts, how much has been spent, and to transfer remaining funds to the newly created State Abortion Access Fund. After that, the Illinois Department of Public Health could use the money to award grants for abortion providers to cover uninsured and underinsured individuals through a new grant program. Mueller presented the bill at the House Human Services Committee on March 25th, where it passed 8-4 along partisan lines, and it was placed on the House calendar for a second reading. My colleagues, we all understand, especially on the Democratic side, how important it is to provide a place for women to access reproductive health care, especially since these rights are under assault in so many places in our country, Mueller said. Federal law prohibits federal money being used for abortion care unless the pregnancy is the result of rape or incest, or the abortion is needed to save the life of the mother, but states have more leeway. Illinois already requires state Medicaid, ACA plans, and private insurances to cover abortions. Mueller said this bill is just another way the state can support people who need abortions for reasons that don't meet federal guidelines. Advocates said it also creates a new funding stream to help providers keep up with demand. Opponents of the Illinois bill point to December 2025 guidance from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid that changed the way funds can be managed and used, although health policy attorneys argue that guidance misinterprets the language in the statute and violates the law. The Illinois Life and Health Insurance Council opposes the Illinois measure, Kate Morthland, its policy and advocacy director, said in a statement. It mirrors the Maryland approach, which federal regulators have already warned exceeds the permissible uses of the segregated funds under Section 1303 of the ACA, creating clear compliance concerns, Morthland said in a statement. She said the Illinois bill risks putting the state at odds with federal regulations and risks legal and operational uncertainty. While we remain committed to working with the sponsor, this bill, in its current form, is not workable for the industry, she said. Since 2022, overturn of Roe v. Wade, Illinois has become a national haven for people seeking abortion care. The state has responded by passing many protections and supporting the clinics that provide these services. According to the governor's office, this fund is not connected to the recently announced Prairie State Access Fund, which is a separate partnership with the Michael Reese Health Trust. The money in the Abortion Access Fund would be entirely made up of money set aside by insurance companies. According to the latest numbers from the Guttmacher Institute, an independent abortion policy research organization, 87,210 abortions were provided by clinicians in Illinois in 2025, a slight decrease from previous years, but still far more than any other state in the Midwest. The numbers represent procedural and medication abortions that were provided in physical facilities and via telehealth. We need to just stay vigilant so that it stays protected in Illinois, because clearly things can change very quickly, as we saw with the overturn of Roe, Mueller said. Illinois, I think, has done a lot, but it's kind of up to the other states to do the same. We just have to stay vigilant. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. It's funded primarily by the Illinois Press. From Tony Reed in Decatur, city adopts $10 million revitalization plan. The city of Decatur now has a $10 million plan to save itself from creeping urban decay and ruin, and it was officially adopted Monday as policy by the City Council. The 16-page document title is the Economic and Community Development 26 through 29 Revitalization Plan, and it's fueled by hefty outside grants topped up with local taxpayer cash. Council members agreed to make it city policy with a unanimous vote. Crafted with public input by the city's Economic and Community Development Department, the plan covers a lot of ground, laying out policy and planning frameworks to do everything from stimulating business and job growth to improving housing and the general quality of life. And the cash will be splashed on practical projects ranging from helping businesses and homeowners upgrade their property to demolishing and clearing away risky structures already beyond help. The need to do something soon to save the city was recently thrown into sharp relief by a study commissioned by the Decatur School District looking at population trends. What came back was a snapshot of an aging community, bleeding jobs, and population with little housing growth, and 40% of those renting their homes spending more than 30% of their incomes on rent. Preston Smith, the expert who authored the study, said the doom writing was on the wall for the school district and its host city. "I cannot tell you how bleak a demographic picture this is," Smith told the school board. It certainly caught the attention of the city council and its professional staff. Recommending that the council adopt the revitalization plan, both city manager Melissa Hahn and economic and community developer Lacey Elsie noted the school district study. They also noted that misery loves company, and Decatur is far from alone in its urban maladies. The trends identified in the study, including declining birth rates, an aging population, and change in household composition, are challenges currently being experienced by many communities, Hahn and Elsie said in a memo to the council. The revitalization plan includes targeted strategies intended to strengthen economic competitiveness, support population stability, and improve long-term community vitality. They said the plan prioritizes creating and retaining employment opportunities because economic growth is the key metric driving everything else that matters, such as population trends. The plan seeks to promote business retention and expansion efforts, be proactive in marketing economic incentives to potential employers, and get busy looking for ways to improve development opportunities while upgrading city neighborhoods with targeted action plans. These efforts support a stronger local workforce environment and help position Decatur to retain residents and attract new households over time, Hahn and Elsie said. Speaking at Monday's meeting, Elsie said the plan had been tweaked significantly in response to critiques from the public and council members. The size of several neighborhood areas selected for concentrated help and attention was expanded, and city staff will now conduct a careful review of city ordinances, policies, and procedures to assess their effectiveness. One big and enduring theme of the whole revitalization plan is prioritizing job growth as the hook to reel in more younger families, to arrest population decline and inject greater economic vitality. But it also seeks to promote quality of life across the age spectrum, tapping grant programs to fund initiatives helping older residents maintain and improve their Decatur residences. The city supports critical home repairs and accessibility improvements that allow residents to safely remain in their homes as they age, said Hahn and Elsie in their joint memo. These investments help preserve existing housing stock, maintain neighborhood stability, and support long-term community vitality. Councilman David Horn liked what he saw, but had some worries. He has spoken previously of the need for greater cooperation with the Decatur School District and better use made of the detailed demographic insights learned from their demographic study as the city seeks to safeguard its collective future. Horn is pleased the revitalization plan will work to strengthen the city's business community and residential neighborhoods, but he wanted it to have a greater sense of urgency and broader focus. "I also feel the plan falls short of the needs of the city for revitalization," he added, "and so I'm supportive of the plan, but I think we could have done better." On page A3, we have more photos from our front page article about agucation. We have a photo of Maroa Forsyth fifth grader Owen Cantwell petting a cow from Twisted H Farm during the agucation program at Richland Community College in Decatur on Monday. And we also have a photo of Tyler March teaching Maroa Forsyth fifth graders about the farm equipment at the agucation program. From our local and national page, Donette Beckett in Decatur, local theater. Damn Yankees debuts Friday. The cast of Decatur Underground Theater will be on stage for their latest production, Damn Yankees the Musical, for 6 shows, April 10th through 12th and 17th through 19th at the Decatur Civic Center, 1 Gary Anderson Plaza. Friday and Saturday shows will be at 7 p.m., Sunday shows will be at 2 p.m. Tickets are $19 for general seating or $24 for front row seats. Fees will be applied. For more information or to purchase tickets, visit DecaturUnderground.com. Tickets are also available at the Decatur Civic Center box office by calling 217-422-7300 or at the door before each show. The Tony Award-winning musical follows baseball fan Joe Boyd, who sells his soul to the devil for the chance to be the home run hitter and guide his favorite team, the Washington Senators, to a win against those damn Yankees. Classic musical numbers include Heart and Whatever Lola Wants. from Valerie Wells in Decatur. Hendrickson to be lauded for leadership. Longtime educator Ken Hendrickson will be honored at the Legacy of Leadership event on Friday, May 1st. The event will begin at 6 p.m. at the hall at 520 East North Street, Decatur. Hendrickson is retiring after 54 years of educational leadership. Tickets are $75 each and tables of 10 are $750. Contact St. Teresa High School, 217-875-2431 or online. To make a donation in honor of Hendrickson, send it to St. Teresa High School, 2710 North Water Street, Decatur, Illinois, 62526. Our topic on our opinion page today is AI overload. And our first column is from Mitch Jones. Jones is the Managing Director of Policy and Litigation at Food and Water Watch, a national environmental organization. He wrote this for InsideSources.com. Halt surge in data centers with national moratorium. Gasoline prices have increased more than a dollar a gallon during the last month as President Donald Trump's war with Iran continues. As a result, many consumer staples that rely on diesel-fueled trucks to reach store shelves are more costly. Food prices are climbing, in part due to a logjam of global fertilizer supply, nearly a third of which depends on the Strait of Hormuz for transit to farmers worldwide. The situation is remarkable, given the president's many years of bold claims and arrogant pledges of dirt-cheap fossil fuels, lower energy prices, and shrinking inflation. He was supposed to be a populist America First leader. Yet energy prices in many areas of the country were already skyrocketing before the conflict with Iran. The driver of these inflated electric bills has been data centers to power artificial intelligence for big technology companies. Indeed, the nation's boom in constructing data centers is dramatically reshaping communities around the country and starkly hurting Americans' budgets. Energy demand from AI data centers in the United States is expected to soar in the coming years, according to research by my organization, Food and Water Watch. Our analysis suggests these facilities could consume up to 12% of total national demand and the equivalent of the energy used by more than 55 million households. The largest of these massive projects may house 5,000 or more computer servers over millions of square feet and consume as much power as 2 million households. This extreme surge in energy demand across the American grid is unsustainable. It is already having grave effects on the environment, climate, and people's finances. Much of the energy needed for AI data centers is produced by fossil fuels, the coal and gas that are driving the climate crisis, producing stronger and more violent storms, raising our sea levels, and slowly cooking our planet. Additionally, giant data centers require vast amounts of water to operate. U.S. data centers will need billions of gallons of water more each year just to cool AI servers. That could fill 1 million Olympic-sized swimming pools, enough water to meet the indoor needs of about 18 million American households. All of this is happening as many communities struggle to provide clean, affordable water for everyday use. Americans will pay for the AI boom with their wallets. Driven largely by new data centers, surging power demand compelled U.S. electric and gas utilities to request $31 billion in consumer rate increases in 2025. Double the total request in 2024, according to a Power Lines report. Average residential electricity rates in the U.S. soared from 20 to 25. This cost crisis is only deepening, but people and communities are fighting back. In October, Food and Water Watch called for a nationwide moratorium on the construction of AI data centers, citing the massive and growing burden on electricity and water resources. Many local, state, and national groups joined in this demand. Responding to the growing public outcry, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent Vermont, recently introduced a bill to enact just such a pause. Meanwhile, community leaders nationwide are taking matters into their own hands, rejecting scores of AI data center proposals in recent months and pursuing multi-year local and statewide halts to the industry's expansion. We need a nationwide pause on the explosive growth of AI data centers now because the industry failed to show it can protect people and our society from harm. We'll read our second column on AI overload in the second half of the newspaper reading. From our food page, we have a recipe today for stir-fried tofu with crispy garlic chili and tofu chocolate pie. A pair of protein-rich recipes that are as easy to prepare as they are delicious, from Gretchen McKay, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Are you looking to eat more protein? You're in good company. According to a 2025 International Food Information Council study, 70% of Americans say they want to consume more of the macronutrient that builds and repairs tissue, skin, and hair, which explains why so many labels on the grocery store shelves these days, everything from breakfast cereal to snacks to beverages, boast about how many grams of protein are in each serving. Describing the stir-fried tofu with crispy garlic chili, tofu is a staple in many Asian cultures' diets. Here, it is fried with aromatics and crunchy garlic with chili oil and then tossed in lime juice. Serve it with your favorite rice. And the tofu chocolate pie. The mousse in this velvety, chocolatey dessert was a little too soft to cut into firm wedges, maybe because I couldn't wait to sample it before it was done chilling. But no worries, I simply spooned it into custard cups. Whipped cream enhances its richness. For the complete recipe and list of ingredients, see the food page B5 in today's Herald and Review. Today in history. On this date in 1820, the Venus de Milo statue, likely dating to the 2nd century BC, was discovered by a farmer on the Greek island of Milos. In 1864, the U.S. Senate passed 38-6 the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, abolishing slavery. The House of Representatives passed it in January 1865. The amendment was ratified and adopted in December 1865. Now from our Nation and World page, digest from the United Nations. Russia, China reject resolution on Hormuz. Russia and China vetoed a UN Security Council resolution Tuesday aimed at reopening the Strait of Hormuz that had been repeatedly watered down in hopes that those two countries would abstain. The vote, 11-2 with two abstentions from Pakistan and Colombia, took place shortly after U.S. President Donald Trump issued an unprecedented threat that a whole civilization will die tonight if Iran does not open the strategic waterway and make a deal. But late Tuesday, Trump pulled back his threat. Trump said he would suspend the threatened attack for 2 weeks, provided Iran agreed to open the Strait of Hormuz. One-fifth of the world's oil typically passes through the strait. Briefly from Turkey. Three assailants opened fire on police Tuesday outside a building housing the Israeli consulate in Istanbul, sparking a gunfight that left one attacker dead, Turkish officials said. The two other assailants were wounded and captured. From Hungary. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance urged Hungarians on Tuesday to support Prime Minister Viktor Orban in upcoming elections, dubbing the populist leader a defender of Western civilization, during a visit to Hungary meant to help push Orban over the finish line. Dog breeds. A New York judge dismissed a lawsuit Tuesday filed by the animal rights group PETA over the health of French bulldogs and some other popular dog breeds, saying a New York law was misapplied to the case. The case accused the American Kennel Club of promulgating unhealthy standards for Frenchies, bulldogs, Chinese Shar Pei's, dachshunds, and pugs. From Indianapolis, an Indiana politician said he and his son were awakened early Monday when someone fired 13 shots at their front door, leaving behind a note reading "No data centers" on their doorstep. Indianapolis Councilman Ron Gibson said they weren't harmed in the incident, which occurred around 12:45 a.m. Monday. From Libya, Ukrainian forces are operating in western Libya under a covert deal endorsed by the West, and they used the northern African country's territory to strike a Russian tanker in the Mediterranean last month, two Libyan officials said Tuesday. Migration. More than 80 migrants went missing after a boat that departed the Libyan coastal town of Tajoura capsized in the central Mediterranean, the UN Migration Agency said Tuesday. The bodies of at least two of them were recovered. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, April 8th. Please stay tuned.